Nemoto presents filmmaking giants. Stanley Kubrick, the architect of obsession. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 39 minutes. Stanley Kubrick. Hello and welcome back to Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World. If Antonioni taught us to listen to absence, Stanley Kubrick taught us to listen to design. To geometry as a temperament, to music as a kind of fate, to technology as both instrument and character. He pushed images until they behaved like propositions. He made rooms that refused to be mere settings. He arranged time so that dread could be measured and wonder could arrive without explanation. And he did all this with a composure that made the extraordinary feel inevitable, as if the camera had simply discovered a physics the rest of us were too hurried to notice. He began with stillness, a boy in the Bronx with a Rolleiflex, a chessboard, and a taste for patience. The chessboard trained him to think in sequences. The camera trained him to think in rectangles. He learned that a small adjustment in angle can turn an ordinary face into a sentence, that light can make a room confess, that a person crossing a threshold tells the truth more reliably than any speech. As a teenager, he photographed boxers and street corners for Look magazine, absorbing how bodies reveal habit and how habit becomes story. The first shorts, then the first features, arrive with the stubbornness of someone who has already decided that persuasion is craftsmanship, not volume. He is young, he is learning, he is also already Kubrick. The early films are exercises in control under pressure. Fear and Desire is barely him, the ghost of a young man trying out metaphors on a war that could be any war, but Killer's Kiss and The Killing snap into a grammar that will persist. The Killing is a heist arranged like a fugue, voices enter and exit. A horse race thunders underneath, a narrator pretends to be a law, the chronology loops and returns and lets cause and effect perform without leaning on coincidence. The camera moves not because motion is exciting but because motion is the only honest way to follow a thought. The last image, money flying across a tarmac like chickens let out of a sack, doesn't scold. It reports, chaos always waits politely for our best plans. Then Paths of Glory. We're in trenches that behave like intestines, a court-martial staged in a ballroom where justice is merely the choreography of rank, and a tracking shot that walks the length of a nightmare in daylight, Kirk Douglas striding past faces set in mud and fatigue, the camera almost scolding itself for being able to move so freely when the men cannot. There is no sermon, there is a geometry of cruelty. And at the end, a tavern and a girl, enemy, foreigner, singing until the room's appetite for humiliation grows up just long enough to remember what caged boys sound like when they fall quiet. Kubrick was never sentimental. He allowed tenderness to be an event. He can do the studio epic and still keep a spine of skepticism. Spartacus is the largest film he will ever direct and the least Kubrickian, because it is a job taken over midstream. Yet within it the director smuggles a lesson about performance and power. The Roman world is built from straight lines and appetites. The slave world is built from bodies and vows. Here we glimpse the double tendency that will become method, a fascination with systems and a refusal to let them name themselves virtue. Control hardens into instrument in Lolita and then into diagnosis in Dr. Strangelove. In Lolita, he leans into the comedy of repression, making the censors chase him through a maze of innuendo, letting James Mason's diction become a mask that fails one syllable at a time. He is learning how to turn sound into plot, the nervous laugh, the cough that pretends to be a period. And then Strangelove detonates. The war room is a set so persuasive that a generation misremembers it as a real place. The table is black as a threat, the lamps are interrogation, the geography is a map of stupidity marching under the banner of procedure. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room. Is less a joke than a proof that decorum will try to rescue itself from consequences even when consequences have already started to glow. Peter Sellers divides into three men because the film needs more than one accent to carry the absurdity. Airbase, bomber cockpit, Washington. Three rooms where men who adore rationality use it to ignite the world. Kubrick lets the camera behave like a clerk, duly recording, while the cutting behaves like prophecy. The mushroom clouds at the end waltz not to cynicism but to recognition. We built a machine and asked it to forgive us. It did not. He writes with silence next. 2001. A Space Odyssey is not a prediction. It is a cleansing. He prunes dialogue until the images can think. A bone thrown by an ape becomes a satellite, the most arrogant match cut in the history of cinema, and yet not a boast so much as the calm of a mind that trusts its audience to connect prehistory to orbit. Spacecraft drift with a grace that makes rockets look like orchestras and astronauts like stagehands. He finds collaborators who can make the fantasy honest. A writer, Arthur C. Clarke, who treats metaphysics like engineering, a designer, Harry Lang, who turns drafting into weather, a composer, Strauss Ligeti, whose music already knows what vacuum sounds like. He invents practical illusions that still feel more real than most software. Front projection that invites prehistoric Africa into a suite at MGM. A rotating set that allows a stewardess to walk in a circle while the camera insists the room is square. Slitskin photography that turns a trip through a machine into a birth canal made of light. He refuses to explain the monolith while letting it behave consistently. He refuses to supply motive while letting evolution answer. For the first time in mainstream cinema, long stretches of a big movie are as quiet as a cathedral. People call it slow. It is slow only if your heart has forgotten another rhythm. The Star Child is not a promise. It is a question delivered in the language of awe. He returns to Earth and removes consolation. A Clockwork Orange jolts after 2001 because it refuses to respect the line between ugliness and elegance. The language, Nadsat, is a jacket sewn from slang in Russian and mockery. The camera glides while bodies do harm. Beethoven finds itself drafted into violation and then later into the dignity of remorse. The movie is accused of glamorizing what it catalogs. The movie asks whether the state's antidote to cruelty, the Ludovico technique, deserves to be called virtue when it makes a man good only by ruining his ability to choose evil. The design is a trap that explains itself. You feel your revulsion and then your bureaucratic relief, and the film takes note of the part of you that likes tidy solutions. No director of his scale has been crueler to our craving for cleanliness. None has been more clinical about the risk that art, his own art, might make harm attractive by photographing it well. His answer is not to refuse elegance. It is to use elegance to escalate your responsibility. Then a pastoral built from iron, Barry Lyndon. He wants to see the 18th century the way eyes who lived in it saw it. So he borrows Lentz's NASA commission for the lunar program, F/0.7 glass made for photographing the dark, and modifies cameras to swallow them, and then he lights scenes with nothing but candles. This is not a stunt. It is a philosophical choice. If you want people to accept a period's manners without imagining themselves superior to the past, you must grant the light that trained those manners to be legible. The compositions look like Gainsborough and Watteau taught the camera to breathe. The zoom is a sigh that refuses to be either flourish or apology. The narrator, a dry clerk, amused by the folly he must recount, escorts us through the career of a man who is neither hero nor villain but a case study in fortune's indifference. Duels are arranged with the eroticism of death's politeness. A mother's ambition is trimmed by arithmetic. A child's death is filmed with the unblinking dignity grief deserves. Of all Kubrick's films, this is the one most often undervalued by people who love speed. Spend an evening with it and you learn that slowness can be a microscope. Now a hotel whose carpets never forget. The Shining is a family drama that gets mistaken for a haunted house and a haunted house that keeps revealing the engineering of a family drama. We follow a child on a tricycle through hallways that curve into themselves like a mind avoiding a thought. We follow a mother who has been apologizing for years. We follow a father whose smile is an accident waiting to admit it isn't one. The Steadicam, Garrett Brown's invention, becomes a character. Not a crane, not a hand, a floating witness that refuses to blink. The Overlook becomes a map we try to master and fail because it is larger than its own blueprints. The score is spare and predatory. The typewriter is a metronome. The snow outside is the silence alcohol promised. The maze, the mirror, the twins, the door, yes, all the iconography that popular memory recites, are careful instruments in a composition about custody, boredom, resentment, and the way isolation teaches a grievance to sound like religion. People enjoy the jump scares. The real terror is bureaucracy. A job that looks like a solution and behaves like a provocation. Then Full Metal Jacket. Proof that he can think like a reporter without giving up his right to think like a metaphysician. He stages boot camp as a ritual that manufactures a language before it manufactures soldiers. Insults that pretend to be discipline, cadence that pretends to be community. R. Lee Ermey, a real drill instructor, becomes a poet of humiliation. the boys learn to answer in chorus because answers are safer when shared. The film's second half moves to an urban war where the enemy is often a building. A sniper stalls a platoon with a patience the institution did not. The ending, Mickey Mouse sung in a voice that cannot decide whether it is proud or exhausted, does not editorialize. It sets down a shoulder and lets the audience decide which part of their own training it just recognized. He finishes with Eyes Wide Shut, a film often misremembered as Scandal and better described as Confession. A couple who love each other test how much they can afford to say. Desire becomes a mirror that plays tricks with light. Manhattan is rebuilt in London because the geography of New York matters less than the temperature of secrecy. Christmas lights turn every room into an altar for appetites. Masks allow a ritual to impersonate sacrament. Class behaves as immunity until it becomes exposure. He shoots long conversations like exams. He refuses to cut on the comfort beat. He lets Tom Cruise's face learn humility a millimeter at a time. The famous final word is less a gasp than a treaty. The film understands that monogamy is an art made of negotiated attention, and that fantasy's proper place is not court but chapel. What is the kid he leaves? Geometry made humane. One-point perspective is not a parlor trick in Kubrick. It is the ethics of attention. When a hallway converges to a vanishing point and he sets you moving toward it, he is promising that the world can be navigated if you notice how it is built. Symmetry is not a boast. It is a discipline that reveals asymmetry when it matters. He uses the center like a vow. If something is placed there, it is either power demanding reverence or innocence requiring protection. When either is missing, the empty center is an indictment. Sound, in his films, is never mere punctuation. He learned early to distrust the illusions that libraries of music can permit. When he uses classical music, it is because the shot needs an argument that only a composer can supply. The courage of Strauss is also Sprach Zarathustra to announce a dawn. The waltz irony of the Blue Danube turning docking procedures into courtship. Ligeti's choir arriving to remind matter that it is haunted. When he uses diegetic sound, he lets the story become accountable to a room. Boots on tile, the hush in vacuum, a rope hissing through a hand. He understands that the ear is a better conscience than the eye. Audiences will forgive a beautiful lie. They do not forgive a sound that contradicts their memory of reality. His method with actors is a cause of legend and argument. He took many takes. He insisted not on an interpretation but on a rhythm. He asked actors to be available to a beat and then another, until performance shed habits and a person arrived. The stories of his severity are real, so are the memories of his protection. Shelley Duvall recalls cruelty, R. Lee Ermey recalls freedom, Malcolm McDowell recalls punishment, Nicole Kidman recalls patience, Danny Lloyd recalls care. The truth is not a verdict, it is a ledger. He wanted the thing to be right. The moral remainder, how much a director owes the people he protects and exhausts, remains part of his inheritance to the craft. His set etiquette, quiet, meticulous, monastic, is another part, as is his habit of testing everything himself. Lenses, dollies, chemistry, the math of a dissolve. Research is not decoration with him, it is ritual. For 2001, he asked engineers what would bend and what would not. For Barry Lyndon, he read The Century until it could no longer perform for him. For Full Metal Jacket, he built Vietnam out of English brick, proving that truth is sometimes an arrangement of correct distances rather than a passport stamp. For Eyes Wide Shut, he mapped jealousy like a city. Pre-production is where he sintered doubt into steadiness. Production is where he watched. Post-production is where he carved. He wrote in the edit, as all directors do. He edited as if logic were a kindness you owe the viewer. But he also allowed ambiguity when ambiguity was the truth. He did not fear not knowing. He feared pretending. If you make films, you already speak his grammar even when you don't mean to. If you don't, you can carry his habits anywhere that responsibility meets imagination. Try the Kubrick walkthrough before you promise anything. Stand in the room the decision will change and stay until the room begins to change you. Try the lens test. Ask what you are using to see, your own habit, someone else's summary, an instrument, and then ask whether it is distorting in a way you can defend. Try the candle test in work that requires persuasion. Can your idea survive low light? Does it still make sense when the glamour is removed? Try the cut that refuses to flatter. In a memo, remove the sentence that makes you sound wise but adds no information. In a meeting, remove the slide you would have used to seduce. In a design, remove the flourish that disguises confusion. He pushes technology not to brag but to humanize. The Zeiss lenses on Barry Lyndon allow skin to breathe and shadows to live. The Steadicam in The Shining liberates the witness from the dolly's tyranny and from the hand's tremor. The slitskin rig in 2001 replaces explanation with amazement that is, paradoxically, honest. He doesn't make a fetish of the tool. He changes how the tool imagines its own duty. He has enemies. Cold, they say. Pessimist. Control freak. The work answers calmly. The films make space for grief without telling the viewer how to feel. They are not pessimistic. They are adult. Men with buttons will press them. Boys with rifles will learn a song that allows them to sleep. A couple who love each other will need to learn that love's grammar includes embarrassment. Curiosity will put its hand on a monolith and receive more than it asked. Beauty will serve good and evil without prejudice. Systems will do what they are designed to do. If you do not design them, they will design you. As for control, yes, he wanted it. Not because he despised people. He preserved more dignity for actors in their weakest moments than most directors do on their best days. But because he believed that the only way to hand the audience freedom was to remove every error that would make them distrust the room. What does he do to the world's way of seeing? He returns scale. In 2001, the planet is not a postcard. It is a horizon your mind must walk. In Barry Lyndon, the 18th century is not a stage. It is an ecosystem. In The Shining, a hotel is not a set. It is a test of a marriage. In Full Metal Jacket, a war is not a thesis. It is a schedule. He is not mystical. He is reverent toward how big things actually are. He gives back to rooms their right to be larger than their occupants. He gives back to silence the right to be more articulate than explanation. There is also, everywhere, the humor of a man who recognizes that the serious and the ridiculous are roommates. Strange Love is a comedy in which the punchline is annihilation. The Shining is a haunted house where the ghost is debt, emotional, financial, spiritual, and the punchline is a photograph. Barry Lyndon is a tragedy whose leading man keeps tripping on carpets and whose last joke is a ledger. All are equal now. He never laughs at the wrong person. He asks the audience to stop confusing its own cleverness with knowledge. When his films end, they often end with an image that refuses to be exhausted. A fetus hovering above Earth, a hand on a shoulder with a mountain beyond, a ballroom photograph, a woman's face at candlelight as she recognizes the difference between luck and mercy, a courtyard seen through iron. The aftertaste is not message, not moral. It is attention retrained. He has moved your eye and your ear to a different alignment, and that alignment will make your next hour a little less sloppy. You can try him at home without a camera. Put on a piece of music that was not written to flatter you. Stand in the doorway of a room you use every day and describe it as if you have never seen it. Write one sentence about a fear and remove every adjective. Make a schedule and remove three items you cannot do honestly without injuring someone's trust. If you must make a speech, give it once to an empty chair and cut it by a third. If you must apologize, choose a light in which your face does not look better than you deserve. Read a page of history, not to confirm your tribe's righteousness but to borrow a century's eyesight. Teach a child chess and let them win exactly when they have actually learned something. All of this is Kubrickian without being a pastiche. Respect for design as ethics. He will always be accused of making a cinema of intelligence rather than a cinema of feeling by people who have learned to recognize only extroverted feelings. But his films are full of pity. He refuses to exploit it. Think of the young German girl singing in Paths of Glory, her voice trembling to find a key that men hardened by fear can live inside for the length of a verse. Think of the tender clumsiness between Barry and his son, the nurse's hand on Alex's head in the hospital, Halloran's trip through the snow because a boy he barely met needs a witness, a wife's face the morning after a confession. These are not speeches. They are arrangements of space and time that allow decency to reappear. He died in 1999, the eyes wide shut, cut still warm, the archives full of boxes labeled in a script that looks like a draftsman's patience. The popular memory carries the silhouette of a man with a beard behind a camera, peering into a viewfinder as if the world owes him steadiness. The films carry something gentler, a suggestion that steadiness is a courtesy you extend to the truth when you ask it to stand still long enough to be recognized. He changed how we see the world by proving that the camera can be a moral instrument, by showing that design is not a luxury but a responsibility, by returning silence to the soundtrack without apology, by treating time as a sculptable medium rather than a conveyor belt, by filming systems until they were embarrassed into revealing whom they serve. He left behind not a formula but a standard. You do not have to meet it. You do have to know it exists. Thank you for listening to this episode of Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World. Martin Scorsese. Hello and welcome back to Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World. We have been traveling through rooms governed by ritual and design, through slow time and dream logic and the ethics of geometry. Now we step into a neighborhood where the corners are sharp, the sidewalks remember names, and the camera never quite stops moving because conscience never quite rests. Martin Scorsese was a child in Little Italy with asthma and a parish calendar for a clock. He grew up watching the mass as theater and the streets as counter theater, and he learned early that guilt, love, appetite, loyalty, and grace can occupy the same frame without any of them surrendering their force. He took that education to a lens and built a cinema where movement is morality, music makes arguments, and editing turns thought into a rhythm you can hear in your chest. He changed how we see the world by returning attention to the fork in a life, the second before a choice hardens, by refusing to let harm hide behind charm or redemption hide behind piety, and by treating every cut as an oath about where truth lies. He tells the story of lying in bed as a boy with a cough that would not quit and finding that when your breath is short the world arrives in fragments. A priest's sleeve, incense, the way light enters through stained glass like colored waves, a butcher's joke on a stoop, the theater of a neighborhood feast day, a gangster's car idling half a block away the way a thought idles, ready to make trouble. The church taught him that form can carry tenderness. The block taught him that tenderness without discipline gets eaten alive. Parents took him to the movies because the movies were air conditioning and air. The child discovered a grammar that was not Latin and not English. The camera moves and you feel permission. The camera stops and you feel a judge entering the room. He imagined the priesthood. He found instead the altar of the edit bench. He went to NYU with a pocket full of saints and song lyrics and an itch to turn rooms he knew into frames the world could know. The early work already carried the fidget of responsibility. Who's that knocking at my door is the tremor of a young man trying to grow up without breaking the commandments and discovering that hypocrisy breaks them first. The film is rough. Faces too close, music too loud, jump cuts that act like apologies and then like boasts. But in its impatience you can hear the metronome set for a career. He met Thelma Schoonmaker around then, a cutter whose hands would become his conscience. He met actors who did not flinch when asked for embarrassment. He met a city that kept supplying unphotographed truths. Out of that came Mean Streets, a film that turns handheld into a creed and neon into a weather report. You don't make up for your sins in church, the voice inside says, you do it in the streets. The camera agrees. It walks into bars the way the guilty walk into confessionals, sideways, ready to bolt. It follows a man's head into a sink and turns the water on as if baptism could be borrowed for an evening. It lets a song crash into conversation because in the life the film knows, songs do that. They assert themselves like old friends who bring their own trouble. He never leaves that parish of guilt and song. He exports it. Taxi Driver is a diary you can drive. Travis Bickle writes in a notebook the way cities write in steam. Feverish, repetitive, afraid. Paul Schrader's sentences ache with isolation. The camera turns those sentences into a map. Slow dolly in on the yellow cab as if obsession had wheels. Lateral glide past the girl in the campaign office as if hope were a pane of glass. Greenish streetlight turning rain into insomnia. Bernard Herrmann's last score, swelling like the false confidence that keeps a man awake for days. God's lonely man, the voice says, and the film does not contradict him. It simply confirms that loneliness allows the devil to speak in complete sentences. The gun barrel, the mirror, the FOMO hawk, the make-believe cleanse, it all arrives with the calm of procedure. Scorsese has no interest in glamour here. He is interested in diagnosis. Violence erupts not because a movie requires it but because a man has confused attention with love and rage with vocation. The film ends ambiguously because the disease does. Societies that won't look their loneliness in the eye sometimes reward it when it puts on a suit. Then the ring becomes a confessional. Raging Bull is a black and white catechism placed in a boxing gym. Michael Chapman's camera learns to breathe in time with Jake LaMotta's cruelty. Flashbulbs pop like accusations. Punches sound like animals, the meat of a man insisting on being heard. The fighting is not spectacle, it is punctuation. The film's real punches land in kitchens and hallways. Scorsese and De Niro invent a portrait of self-destruction without letting brilliance excuse it. The cutting pattern is penitent and savage. A flurry, a hold, a breath you think will be mercy, another flurry. The great silence, Jake rehearsing a nightclub act in a mirror years later, saying lines from On the Waterfront as if repentance were a monologue you could borrow, arrives without strings. "I could have been a contender," the man mutters, and the camera does not argue. The movie believes that confession without change is theater. It respects theater. It reserves forgiveness for the inconvenient work of altered behavior. His cinema keeps returning to the fall as an event and to the rooms where the fall is prepared with coffee and friendship. Goodfellas is the seduction built like a song. As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. A voiceover that feels like invitation. A freeze frame that arrests the boy mid-run because memory prefers control. A camera sliding through the Copacabana kitchen and onto the club floor in one long unbroken apology for how easily attention can become complicity. The Copacabana shot is not a flex. It is thesis. Watch how charm rearranges a building to suit itself. Watch how a man moves when he believes rules are for other people. The rock tracks are not wallpaper. They are commentary, a parallel voice telling you who these people think they are. The editing is a drug on purpose. You feel the generosity of the early reels, the jokes, the tips, the easy cash. And then, as cocaine enters the bloodstream, the cuts accelerate, the day chops itself into gestures, a helicopter becomes a conscience that refuses to stop hovering, sauce stirs, guns hide, phone calls layer, Henry's face learns the grammar of paranoia. Scorsese never cheats. The pleasure is genuine. The bill is not negotiable. Casino revises the hymn as a manual. Where Goodfellas swims in neighborhood intimacy, Casino is a case study in systems. Greed dressed as architecture, Las Vegas as a theology of light and credit. The narration splits into lanes like a divided highway. The camera treats counting rooms as catechisms. Sharon Stone enters and the film learns another octave of pain. Scorsese does not apologize for loving the machinery. He examines it the way a physician examines a tumor, fascinated and grim. He knows the camera can make vice sexually attractive. His answer is to show the price until desire learns arithmetic. The montage where skim money flies through conduits, into cars, onto planes, into envelopes, into pockets back home, is love of form turned into criticism. Elegance pressed into service for truth. In the 1980s, he made a trilogy of exhaustion. The King of Comedy, After Hours, The Color of Money, that diagnosed a country entering a mirror without noticing it had left the room. The jokes in King are brittle because the comedian wants the affection of strangers as a medicine for a childhood that never stopped. The city in After Hours is a labyrinth that punishes a man specifically for believing he is the protagonist of other people's lives. The camera glides like a sly friend who keeps trying to retrieve your dignity. The Color of Money lets a veteran teach a kid and learns in the process that mentorship is a recipe for revenge if you are not careful. The lesson that runs under all three is simple. Charm without a moral project is a solvent. He wandered into blasphemy to test the border between piety and courage. The Last Temptation of Christ scandalized those who mistake sanctity for insulation. Scorsese films Jesus as a man who loves God so much that temptation must be real or the love is counterfeit. The camera goes handheld on purpose. A God who entered history deserves a lens that refuses to float above mud. The argument the film makes, against literalism in favor of devotion, is consistent with his career. He believes in the dignity of bodies and the necessity of choice, and he shows both with a fervor inherited from catechism, corrected by cinema. He can be lush when he must be severe and severe when a studio would prefer lush. Kundan treats Tibetan ritual with the patience he normally reserves for jazz. Bringing out the dead gives a paramedic the hours that previously belonged to a cabbie and lets a city confess its grief. Gangs of New York builds a myth, slashes it with history, and watches a nation teach itself to kill politely. The aviator admires obsession until it stops pretending to be vision. The Departed arranges a double helix of deceit and trims it into tragedy at the pace of a comedy. Shutter Island turns genre into a device that slowly refuses to let the viewer off the hook. Hugo forgives the boy in the train station and makes preservation into a children's crusade without lying about melancholy. The Wolf of Wall Street refuses to be the PSA some viewers begged for and instead gives depravity enough rope to make an argument against itself. Silence prays with the patience of a monk who knows that an answer may damage a soul if it arrives too early. The Irishman replaces sparkle with ash and lets age turn everything into inventory, a long afternoon where the last thing you have left to consume is your own story. In each of these, the same hand, a camera that moves when a thought does, an edit that accelerates when conscience cheats, music that flatters until it indicts, an actor permitted to fail beautifully and then asked to live with the failure without narration as anesthesia. Outside the features is an archive of loving pedagogy. A personal journey with Martin Scorsese through American movies and my voyage to Italy are not lectures. They are visits to rooms that made him. He sits beside sequences like a parishioner explaining a favorite psalm, pointing at cuts and glances and gestures as if they were stained glass. He honors Poverty Row craftsmen and Hollywood monarchs alike. He insists that the canon is a house with many doors. He made documentaries shaped like gratitude letters, Italian-American to his parents, The Last Waltz to a Band's Last Public Breath, No Direction Home to a Singer Who Refused to Let the Decade Use Him, George Harrison, Living in the Material World to a Searching Soul, Rolling Thunder Review to the Lie That Tells the Truth. These films expand his influence past his own frames into a culture of attention. He is not just a director, he is a steward. That stewardship becomes policy in the Film Foundation and its World Cinema Project, a quiet revolution that restores films condemned by neglect, Egyptian melodramas that turn out to be bolder than we remembered, Filipino epics less fragile than our archives, Indian noirs that reveal how a street corner thinks, Senegalese miracles that show how elegance can live without money. Scorsese has spent as much time saving other people's images as making his own. He believes, fiercely, and he is right, that memory is a public infrastructure. You do not have to love his subjects to benefit from the habit he models. Build institutions that outlast your temper. What makes the images move like they do? Start with the body of the camera. When Scorsese pushes into a face, you feel confession approaching. When he backs away, you feel a lie clearing its throat. When he drifts sideways, you feel an opportunity for grace passing. The Copacabana shot is a sermon about how power smooths logistics. The clockwise circling and raging bull mimics a fighter's search for angle and a sinner's search for alibi. The heat shimmer and paranoid cutting in The Last Day of Goodfellas are the body's report on a chemistry problem. He is not addicted to long takes. He is addicted to the exact take for the exact thought. Then the edit. Thelma Schoonmaker's hands have the gentlest authority in American cinema. Together they invented a way to cut that refuses to choose between jazz and metronome. Freeze frames in Goodfellas are not decorations. They are gilt's photographs. Slow motion is an affidavit. Smash cuts are a judge's gavel. The famous jump forward to music cues, from Be My Baby to Gimme Shelter, to opera arias used not for grandeur but for precision, argue that songs are arguments. He uses them to persuade you that a person has made a choice they cannot unmake. In The Departed, the drop into Dropkick Murphys is not local color. It is a thesis about identity as costume. Voiceover with him is not laziness. It is confession. He gives the story to the sinner and lets the sin charm you for long enough that your complicity becomes evidence. Travis's diary, Henry Hill's salesmanship, Jordan Belfort's parade, they are all tactics, and the camera allows them to function until the tactic exhausts itself. Then silence falls, and the film asks you to examine who you are without the narration flattering you into verdicts. Violence is in the house he builds, but he does not stage it to congratulate fear. He stages it to teach consequences. The gun in Taxi Driver does not solve loneliness, it industrializes it. The beating in Casino is filmed in a light too bright to be heroic. The Irishman's bullets are short, ugly verbs. The blood in Raging Bull is in black and white because the man's life needs to read as an X-ray, not a painting. He will not let you mistake energy for virtue. All this technique matters because of the moral questions he refuses to dodge. What do we owe the people we have charmed? What do we owe the people we have harmed? Can a person change without inventing a theater to confuse themselves? What is the difference between faith and the performance of faith? How does friendship survive ambition? How does love survive the confession that arrives 10 years late? He does not sit in judgment. He arranges the scene until judgment becomes a necessity and then he leaves you with it. Bring him into your work and life without a camera. Let music be a tool, not a narcotic. Choose a song for your next meeting that tells the truth about what you're doing there. Then refuse the song if you realize it's lying for you. Borrow his tracking shot for a day. Walk the path a customer or patient takes, through the kitchen, past the hallway, into the room, until the logistics confess their morals. Use voiceover the way he does. Write the internal monologue your team is carrying but won't say. Let it exist on paper. Then decide which lines must be spoken and which must be retired. Edit your week like Goodfellas edits a day. Accelerate only when a genuine deadline compresses. Otherwise, restore a rhythm where attention can breathe. If your organization uses charm to cover harm, stage the Copacabana shot of your process and let everyone watch who gets moved to the front. If you are a maker, there is another kit. Risk embarrassment on screen. He asks actors to carry contradictions and then protects them while they do it. Protect your collaborators when they try something that might fail. Keep faith with the cut. Remove the flourish that stops information from moving. Align camera movement with thought rather than with spectacle. If a shot is beautiful and dishonest, destroy it. Save other people's work. Preserve your field's memory. Spend real time on apprentices. When you teach, bring film clips, not as trophies but as tools. Put the cut up and ask the room what each splice asks of the viewer. Read widely. Let theology and pop songs argue in your head until the argument becomes music. He has defects and he knows it. Women in his films sometimes carry men's redemption on their backs. He has spent late work correcting that laziness with curiosity and respect. His love of masculine codes can shade into patience with violence. He vandalizes that patience with Silence and The Irishman, where endurance and sorrow take over the frame. The culture occasionally weaponizes his old images to flatter cruelty. He answers by making new images that hang guilt where it belongs. He is, above all, a worker who has forgiven himself the romance of genius and prefers the discipline of collaboration. The list of names under his titles, designers, cinematographers, props, stunt coordinators, costume, sound, is a map of gratitude. Thelma Schoonmaker's name is not beneath his, it is across from it, in spirit. He is also funny, a detail critics sometimes trample in the rush to crown him prophet. The jokes in Goodfellas are as deliberate as the cuts. The phone that collapses as Ray Liotta laughs in the midnight booth is a sight gag with theology. Don Rickles in Casino is not color. He is an argument about what a gambler is. The last words in The Departed are a visual pun so black the credits need to arrive quickly to protect the audience. He has always known that laughter, placed correctly, opens a door in a heart no sermon can budge. In late interviews and in the classroom visits he sneaks between mixes and cuts, he talks about film like a parishioner talks about bread. He is not nostalgic, he is grateful. He remembers reels and scratches and magnetic stripe. He welcomes digital when it preserves and trembles when it cheapens. He scolds the commerce that treats attention as pasture and sells it by the pound. He urges patience when patience is what makes seeing possible. He loves the past without wanting to live there. He believes the next image should be made by someone who has learned to love the truth more than themselves. He changed how we see the world by making attention a moral practice. He taught the camera to follow a choice into a back room and to wait there until the cost appeared. He taught editors to think like musicians, not accountants. He taught audiences that charm is not a defense and that confession without change is a performance. He taught a generation of makers to move the camera only when a thought moves and to cut only when a conscience does. He taught institutional life that preservation is not luxury, it is infrastructure. And he taught anyone who will listen that love of craft does not absolve us of the work of mercy. It equips us for it. Thank you for listening to this episode of Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World.